I'm Quincy McCoy, KPFA's new general manager. For 65 years, KPFA has been leading the revolution for free speech radio, providing a voice, giving power to you, the people, on issues vital for our community's rights, health, and welfare. KPFA is a place where opposites come together. It's where community is built on the strengths of individuals. Our staff is a diverse palette of folks dedicated to delivering notable service to the community. KPFA is united by the belief that the information that goes out on the air supplies our progressive spirit and character to our listeners and stakeholders. KPFA is the tribal drum, the heartbeat of the community, always vigilant to keep the people aware and well-informed. We need your help to keep the beat and the heat on those who threaten our freedom to speak to power. Please support us during this short fund drive. Remember, your donations ignite the engine that keeps this historic community station fighting for the way forward. Thank you.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is a minute past 2 p.m. Up next, the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, back from Hollyhock and Cortez Island and the summer gathering of many great people and convening the Trickster Training Council, which was adorable. So here we are, and here we are in Fun Drive. So today we're having magic word women, deeply poignant and powerful. We're going to begin by replaying my interview, conversational cavorting with Elizabeth Gilbert. We are offering her fantabulous book, The Signature of All Things, for pledging. We will be diving into why it's such a great book. It really is. But the second half, we honor our great ally, Margot Adler, whose radio journey began at KPFA. You'll hear her delineate that. And she died on July 28th. Very sad. All of her publishers and all the people I've been in contact with are like, oh, we can hardly believe it. And of course, pulling up all the emails from Margot and all the wonderful things. You know, Margot Adler was a great NPR journalist, again, started at KPFA, but also a complete out there, you know, Pagan, her first book, Drawing Down the Moon. The second half, we are going to be replaying some of the interview, the spirited conversing that we had, Margot and I, on February 6th, her book, Vampires Are Us, also available for pledging. You can call 1-800-439-5732 or 510-848-5732 or pledging online, kpfa.org. The Signature of All Things, a fantastic book by Elizabeth Gilbert, is yours for a pledge of $85. Again, you get two things. You get to support this fantastic station, now more important maybe than ever. Well, we always say that, but I think it's really true. And also, you can have Vampires Are Us by Margot Adler for a pledge of $90, or both of them, and they do work oddly well together. I'll weave it, both for a pledge of $160. So that's what we're offering, but think of it also as the power of women and words, and also holding Margot Adler in our hearts as such a great ally, and so poignant to have her death just now. But we begin with the conversational conversing with Elizabeth Gilbert. We think. We're working on it. It is a day of interesting kerfuffles. Yeah, there we go. Eat, Pray, Love, who grew up on a Christmas tree farm in Connecticut without TV or record player, but reading The Wizard of Oz and the wonderful character Ozma, and also reading Charles Dickens, born on the same day as Charles Darwin, in whose latest novel, The Signature of All Things, we can find these things. But also, just for the fun of it, Elizabeth Gilbert is born with the sun in Cancer, the old language says ruled by the moon, but really what it means is incarnation of the moon, and where would her moon be but in Virgo? Me too, moon in Virgo. And as we spiral our conversing out on July 3rd, the moon is in Virgo. Moon in Virgo was called the witch's moon, the writer's moon, since the Renaissance.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. That's right. It was thought of specifically, this is why it's so fun, Elizabeth, as the magic of language, as calling in genius. We go, that's fantastic. So,
hello.
So welcome from the same witch's, writer's moon, you know, ancient, dedicated to botany realm, Elizabeth Gilbert.
Can I ask you how many of these moons we get a year?
Well, the moon's in Virgo every, 2 days every month, but we happen to be coinciding.
Oh. That's good.
My moon in Virgo, your moon in Virgo, but it is the magic of language. And part of why I have been so eager and with your wonderful publicist to track you down is I so love this novel, The Signature of All Things. I love it. I've been lecturing about it and talking about it for ever since I finished reading it. And I think it's a book that keeps going. It keeps going in my psyche afterwards, going, oh, it's very rich. The characters are very alive. So maybe we begin, I did just watch your TED Talk, and I go, oh, that's on demons and genius. And ole, 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 let's bring that topical thing into play, since Americans have learned the soccer chant, ole, ole, ole. Can you remind us where that comes from?
Yeah, fascinating to know that originates in southern Spain during the Arab Muslim incarnation of southern Spain. Mm-hmm. they would do these incredible mythic dances in the middle of the night, and when a dancer achieved such a remarkable piece of transcendence that they no longer looked like a human and looked instead divine, people would chant Allah, 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 as if to say, that's God right there. And that morphed over the years into ole, 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 which people still chant at bullfights and in flamenco dances when somebody has done something magnificent, or on the soccer field, ditto.
Right. Well, it's very witty of life and the power of words to, as living forces. So, yes, let's talk just briefly about what you bring up in your fantastic TED Talk about daemons and genius and the model of inviting in this quality of ingenuity, genius, and inspiration.
Well, I have I have an idea about creativity that I think it stands in kind of direct opposite to German Romanticism, which I've always been against.
Uh-huh.
The model of German Romanticism does seem to say that, your genius will destroy you, and
right.
the evidence of your authenticity as an artist is that you will be ruined by your creativity and you will destroy the lives of everybody around you. It has a lot to do with the embracing of suffering, the sort of the angst and the struggle. And the feeling that I have is that there's an older way to do creativity that people have been doing it, I think, for 3,000 years before we got all La Boheme about it.
Yes.
And that is a sort of collaboration between a human being's labor and the mysteries of inspiration. And the sort of operative thinking that I've had about that is that ideas are an animate life force. They circle the universe looking for a human collaborator to come into a relationship with, and they're constantly trying to find somebody who's open and available enough to work with them. It's sort of like, are you my mother? Are you my mother? Are you my mother? And ideas, circle the world looking for their human partner, and they may come to you and ask you if you want to work with them, and then you have to decide whether you want to enter into that contract. And then when you do, it becomes a partnership. It is not a question of you being being either the slave to the news or the master of the news, which is, I think, the language that's usually used, which is all sort of about dominance. It's really just about a conversation that you're having, where you bring your labor and your work, and inspiration brings the idea, and you try to work it out together.
That is so fabulous. It's wonderful. British writer Terry Pratchett says, genius is always sleeting through the universe until it finds a receptive molecule, and then it's like, Shakespeare.
Nice! Write that down even as I'm talking to you.
There you go. Because this idea, you know, and exactly, you've set this crucial frame in your book and in your life and in your just conversing now. What we've said for 18 years on this show is better a trickster than a martyr, that martyrdom is a mean trick of the reality police, German Romanticism and all, to keep, you know, and it's part of empire and dominance because it is about domination, you know, and in the Grail legend, Sir Balin and Sir Balin are given these wonderful skills from the fairy realm, and the fairies say, acknowledge us and return these important swords, and they go, no, we will keep them, and they go, well, then you're going to kill the thing you most love. So this collaborative, you know, because where we are now, collapse of empire, colonialism, rise of culture of reverent renaissance, collaborate with everything. Anyway, perfect. So yes, the partnership collaborative model of animism, really. Everything's alive. So how interesting.
It's more playful, too.
Yeah. Oh, much more.
It's more playful, and it's also more, you know, the idea that I have is that there's never a war, right? And if you make it one, my feeling I have with artists who fetishize their torment is that while they're having a temper tantrum, the muse is sort of sitting quietly in the corner filing her nails, sort of waiting for you to calm down and go back to work. Like, it's all just sort of a distraction. We're here to make things, you know? We're here to make things, not to make drama around making things.
Right. And the difference, yeah, between the martyr in German Romanticism and the Romantic poets who are always, you know, killing themselves all day, is, you know, again, takes on the unconscious of the culture, and then goes, oh, I've taken it on, I'm so sensitive now, I'm dead. The trickster,
yeah.
The trickster takes on the unconscious material of the culture, but then invites in what can metabolize the poison or form a healing collaboration. Perfect, rather than tantrum yoga. So, in your fabulous book, The Signature of All Things, it is therefore really intriguing that, you know, kind of like Scully, the woman, wonderful Alma, whom we know from pre-birth all the way and spend a lot of time with her, and also in her 50s, 60s, 70s as well, which is important and powerful to do that. But she's given the task of being the science person, her father's daughter, and Ambrose, the la la la, is kind of the martyr to his own fairy spirituality in some way, you know. So that's part of the conversing, right?
Yeah, I thought it would be fun to sort of turn that around. There's a lot of stuff in their relationship that I wanted to play with in terms of gender. You know, Alma's the pragmatist, she's the empirical thinker, she's very, you know, she will not believe it if it cannot be proven, and I had to keep her loyal to that for her entire life because that's her character, and I thought it would be disloyal to ever have her slip out of that. And yet she falls in love with the dreamiest, most romantic artist that you could possibly imagine, who doesn't even want to have a body, he just wants to be air. And Alma is all body. She's carnal, she's lusty, she's passionate, he's ethereal. It makes sense to me because she spends her life studying mosses that are, you know, right up the earth, and he spends his life painting orchids, which don't even need soil in which to grow. They like grow in the sky. And it's like the old adage, a bird and a fish may indeed fall in love, but where shall they live? That sort of becomes their story. And it's not totally the final chapter of the book that a character appears in the form of the great Alfred Russel Wallace, my science boyfriend, who manages to reconcile the two, and presents a theory that is inclusive of both mind and spirit in a really wonderful way. Alma doesn't exactly embrace it because she just doesn't have that space within her. But I'm definitely on team Alfred Russel Wallace when it comes down to that.
Although absolutely, and also very, very important dog, which is always a plus for me in books. But yes, when they are to be married, treasure of my soul, Ambrose says, and again says anything that so many women would want. You know, it is in our sleep we most closely glimpse the power of spirit. Our minds will speak across this narrow distance. It will be here together in nocturnal stillness that we shall finally become unbound by space, by natural law. We shall roam the world however we like in our dreams. We will speak with the dead, transform into animals and objects, and fly across time. Our intellect shall be nowhere to be found, and our minds will be unfettered. Well, what a great, you know, courtship thing, but he can't follow through again.
He just wants to have sex.
Right, exactly. Going,
like, thank you. I don't totally know what you're talking about, but I really want to have sex with you. And I thought it was interesting, too, it's a thing that we don't see very often is women's desire thwarted. You know, there's always that story of a man who's in love with a beautiful, elusive woman he can't get, and the madness and frustration and insanity that brings to him. As a woman who has at times been thwarted and sort of humiliated by being rejected, I think it's important to write about what it feels like to be a woman lying next to a man who doesn't desire you in the way that you desire him. It's horrible. And it's something that I feel like we don't see very much in literature, and I really wanted to go all the way into it.
And it is an ongoing kind of mythic theme right now, especially by the astro mythology of this summer. The image at Saturn stations is a woman made fertile by her own spirit, which I think you've invited into Wonderful Alma. You know, all right, everybody, there are these polarities. Everybody get married to yourself, and then we can talk, you know, maybe several centuries after Alma lives, you know. and also, do you, you grew up reading, you know, the Wizard of Oz books, so you know the character Ozma, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so she's
a relative of mine.
She's a relative, that's right, because she is bespelled to become a boy, but then lifts the spell and is returned happily to her girlness, right?
And do you remember the army of girls who liberate the city, who liberate Ozma's kingdom from the women? Do you remember this weird...
No, but I got to find it immediately.
It's in one of the later books.
Wow.
Women take over Ozma's universe, and they become so tyrannical that they have to be liberated by an army of girls.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Really amazing and really interesting.
Right.
He was a great suffragette.
Through his wife, who was also a theosophist, yeah.
Yeah, a really interesting family. But that was probably the most formative reading of my life, was growing up with all those Oz books. And my God, what a great gift that was.
And on a Christmas tree.
Childhood.
On a Christmas tree farm.
On a Christmas tree farm.
Which is, I mean, everything real, everything symbolic, and speaking to us, we go, that's kind of charming, an ancient pagan rite.
My dad was well aware of.
He was.
But it's also, it's an interesting combination of the magical and the mundane, which I think is a really good model for becoming a creative person. You know, like we provided magic for people, but most of it was done through really boring labor all year. And I think that's a little bit of kind of what it's like doing a novelist's work as well. You know, you can't get to that magic without the discipline of sitting down and doing the work that I learned to do on farm. Going through the boring part to get to the transcendent part.
So that's why we need the routy sometimes. I want you to let us invite in the genius of the routy tradition, which I have underlined everywhere in your book, because Alma, what I tell the people in my enthusiasm, going, yes, Eat, Pray, Love, that was fabulous, yeah, but keep going, because some genius was invited into this material. She's really doing it, because this novel is so alive, and it does continue to live when we finally even close the last page.
It's that's wonderful.
Yeah, well, the characters are alive. I mean, they are. I love Miguel Rivera, wonderful ally that I work with at poetry conferences sometimes, and he says he keeps the fire going in the woods, because when the storytellers are on stage telling the story, that's great, but when they leave, the characters need some place to go hang out, and that's what he provides. And I go, I love that.
I love that. You know, it's funny, when Alma showed up, because the first 60 pages of the novel tell the story of Alma's father and mother, but mostly her father, and his rise, because it was important for me to show how it was that she was born to the wealthiest man in the New World, and how he got that way, and like what her heritage is in a way. And he was such a great character to write, because it was so fun and liberating to write a character who has no moral code.
survivor guy.
survivor. He's a conqueror. He's a survivor, and he's and he goes. I say in the novel, he had only one calculation: for every encounter, I will win. And it was just so like energetically powerful to write that guy, and so fun. And then when I got to the end of that 60 pages, and Alma was born, and I knew she was to be the character of the book, I remember saying to her, "You have to live up to your father." Mm-hmm. You know, like we've already like been jolted by the energy of this guy. You've got to, your story has to hold up. So let's go. You know, like really, you're going to have to deliver here. Cause it can't just be the Henry Whittaker story.
And it is also important and profound that, you know, we begin even on page one with Alma's mother having had, you know, babies who die. This is such mm-hmm. an interesting thing. You know, her most recent attempt, a perfectly formed son, had come right to the brink of life, but had then changed its mind on the very morning he was meant to be born, arrived already departed. I know that story. And it's also an important part of the whole, the black seed of Isis. Isis is in the news, right? But Isis is the goddess of nature who presides over many things, but black Isis is over the black seed in somebody's womb for the child that mm-hmm. did not live. Anyway, so that's fabulous. But then, so you invite in Alma. She is a living being, and incredible sweeping, you know, Dickensian novel, and the arduousness of sailing to Tahiti as a woman, as a solo woman in the 19th century, and where she encounters the Rowtee. Can you invoke the Rowtee for us?
Oh, the Rowtee. This is a Tahitian, a figure in Tahitian society. It's a hereditary position called the Rowtee, and the job of the Rowtee is to know by heart the lineage of every person on the island, and to know the heroic deeds of every person's ancestors, and to run next to the warriors as they run into battle, and to yell their lineage at them to remind them of their greatness. So as you're going into battle, the Rowtee is running beside you saying, "You are the son of the serpent killer and the godson of the this and the grandfather of the one who killed the great," you know, to just tell you that in your blood is heroism and courage. And they don't fight. They just remind you. They remind you of where you came from.
Well, they exhort. Sorry.
And there's a lovely line that Winston Churchill had during the Blitz where he said, you know, "We didn't come all this way and cross all these mountains and seas because we're made of sugar candy." You know, I think that's a little bit what the Rowtee was doing. I think that's what Churchill was doing, was being a Rowtee during World War II, you know, saying like, you know, we have this great heritage of endurance and we're going to endure again. We're going to survive. We're going to win. You know, it's kind of like a little bit of a football coach, a little bit of a spirit guide. It's pretty wonderful. And Alma absorbs that into herself, and when she ends up in Amsterdam announcing herself to her relatives, she makes a Rowtee-like speech of her own heritage, her own ancestry, which I think is kind of fabulous.
That's great, and it also, you know, it does tie into Eat, Pray, Love, because I think for many women, you know, like their internal Rowtee, they go, you know, "I did not go through a divorce and go through all this thing to settle for this. No!" as a feisty thing, because then there's the incredible character known as Tomorrow Morning, who also gives the just, oh, what a character. But an incredible, who is Tahitian, powerful, who is an embodiment of...
Yeah, that, because that's a little bit of a spoiler. So we'll...
No, I won't. I'll turn it. But he is a sensual, embodied being. Again, he's a kind of unifying in a way, well, complex. All right, we'll leave him there for the moment, because we're going all too soon to the close of our conversation. Con is with and versus turning. We're turning together in conversation. But what I say to people, and I don't think this is a spoiler, you know, is at the end, you know, Alma is one. Your writing is dazzling, and when you write about the moss, and people go, "Really, moss? How boring!" I go, "No, the writing is dazzling, the moss cave." But as we begin to come to the end of our cahooting here, but the crucial thing is, you know, you do bring up without resolving, you know, in a great living way, the. You know, the greater the crisis, the swifter the evolution, you know, Alma's writing. But she knows, and Darwin knows, that something is missing from the theory, and what's missing is altruism. And maybe that's where we want to deconvene at the moment, if you just want to give, because that's so important to us now.
It's a question that still hasn't been answered satisfactorily. Is that how you pronounce that? Satisfactorily. Woo, I really fell apart in those syllables there. You know, Alma and Darwin and a lot of other evolutionary scientists were unable to come up with an answer that really satisfied them about the place and the role of altruism in human evolution. We do seem to have a sensitivity that is lacking in a lot of other species, even interspecies sensitivity, right? The great example that I love to give right now is that we are going so far out of our way as a species to try to save our predators. Can you imagine another species? I mean, we're trying to save Bengal tigers. We're trying to save polar bears. They eat us. There's no other species that would get together, you know, ants get together and say, we need to save the anteater. You know, like there's this weird sensitivity that we have for emotionality, for altruism, for empathy, that's so heightened and it doesn't necessarily always benefit us in the race for survival. And if survival of the fittest really is 100% true, that sort of should have been bred out, you know, because the battle for life should have said that there's no room for that. And Darwin couldn't quite solve it. Alma couldn't quite solve it either. I think my old boyfriend, Alfred Russel Wallace, had a pretty good answer about it, about how that consciousness was placed into us by a universal intelligence that wanted to commune with us. He was very happy to say that 99.9% of human development can be traced to evolution, but some of it is actually, for lack of a better word, magic. And I'm content with that. I have a lot of room in me for that, but you can see where it would be jarring to the scientific community to put it in those terms, and jarring to the religious community to suggest that evolution had any role in it whatsoever. But I like the middle ground that Wallace took.
Right, and that is so great. So we will continue this conversation spiraling forth out into the memosphere, you know, forever, because it is such a pertinent now conversation. And when you were born, the sun trines Neptune. Neptune is represents the one of the answers. Neptune is altruism vision, because some part of us knows we're all in this dream together. But it's these are longer conversings. But thank you so much. I know you're on your busy book tour for The Signature of All Things, which I cannot recommend highly enough. It is a living thing. It is something you want to talk about. The more people who read it, the better, because it inspires conversation on an ongoing way. So thank you so much, Elizabeth Gilbert.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed every moment of this.
Yay, that was Elizabeth Gilbert and our interview. We are in Fund Drive. Yes, let it be. Let us be routies. Let us be routies to KPFA, and let that KPFA may be routies back to us, going, no, it's no time to give up now. There we go. Remember when KPFA was born, its sun was at 25 Aries, which is a person holding more gifts than they know what to do with. And we go, yeah. And as we segue in a deep way to Margot Adler and our conversation February 6th, Margot Adler began at KPFA and went on to an illustrious career as a credible pagan and news journalist, both absolutely unabashedly. And it is where she began at KPFA. She has great woof to say for that. Margot Adler was born on KPFA's birthday. Her son also is a woman possessed of more gifts than she can hold. And we go, oh, it's been good. So, yes, you can have The Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert for a pledge of $85 to KPFA, which would be great. As again, many things that Elizabeth Gilbert said, we got off in fine fettle, better a trickster than a martyr, collaborative. We're here to make things, not to make melodrama about making things, she said. And again, the routy, the exhortation. But the crucial part for all of us now in micro and macro, you know, the greater the crisis, the greater the evolution, yes. And what the character in The Signature of All Things, again, she's sort of pre-Darwin, she arrives at Darwin's theory before Darwin, but both of them know that there's something missing from their theory of survival of the fittest, that predator-prey is indeed one of the great engines of evolution on this planet, but there's something else, and that's why I bring in at the end going, in the astro-mythological language it's represented by Neptune, altruism, that we're all in this dream together. You know, and let's think of, you know, KPFA and even Fund Drive in a mythic way, in a practical mythic way, as, you know, as an altruism. One is donating to something that donates back. And I do want to do just a shout-out, because we have the most skookum general manager at KPFA with the best name in the world, Quincy McCoy. Ah, God. And when I saw that he was about to be, and then, yes, it's happened, he is the new general manager, and I read his resume, former executive director of Museum of Children's Arts in Oakland, radio veteran for 30 years, on board of Youth Radio International, chief of operations for Salon Studio at Salon.com, president of radio for MTV Network, and on and on and on. Much altruism. And I wrote to him, actually, going, is this true? Is this the right Quincy McCoy? Are you really going to do... Anyway, so we have a great captain on our ship. Again, it is a time, well, for him, for all of us, to go woof, woof, woof. So by calling 1-800-439-5732 or 510-848-5732 or pledging online, kpfa.org, because we have a fantastic dynamic listening audience, really. Hello, Japan. Hello, Alaska. Hello, Mexico. Hello, South Africa, hello Europe, England, hello Midwest, hello Boston, hello even listeners in Washington, D.C. All of you can pledge online, kpfa.org. So Elizabeth Gilbert's book, Signature of All Things, for a pledge of $85, we're going to move to our beautiful friend Margot Adler now. Her book, Vampires Are Us, for a pledge of $90, both for $160. And any amount of pledging is completely welcome. A small amount, a hilariously vast amount, any of those things are completely welcome. May we magnetize those by calling 1-800-439-5732 or 510-848-5732. So we're going to begin with the little smidge of Margot touting KPFA. Margot, so you started at KPFA, again, Mercury retrograde. You've returned home. Bless your heart, you started at KPFA. So KPFA is not a vampire, but it's an antidote to vampirism. Do you want to play with any of these themes to tease people into funding that which is not vampiristic by pledging?
I'll talk a little bit about KPFA. Yeah,
sure.
I will talk a tiny bit about KPFA.
Okay, good.
So here's what. I was a senior in college. I was completely depressed because I had no idea what I wanted to do. And I took that famous test, you know, the test where you're paired with people who are various things in the field. So you find out if you best be a forest ranger or whatever. And everything that came out on top were all the things I'd rejected. So the family business, which was being a shrink, that was like on top. And I knew I wasn't going to do that. Being a musician, I had sort of given that up. Everything was gone. So I went into the counselor and she said, how about social work? And I walked out of there. I was like totally depressed. And two mornings later, in my senior year in college, in 1968, I turned on the radio and it was KPFA. And the news director was reading out loud George Orwell's Politics in the English Language, an incredible essay, an just unbelievable essay. And after that, he started talking about his philosophy of news and how he believed that we should just call things by their real names. Now, that seems like natural, but in 1968, it wasn't, because it was the Viet Cong, not the National Liberation Front. It was the Red Chinese, not the Chinese. If you were describing an intelligence vessel, and it would be Soviet snoop ship, and, you know. So he just said, we believe in calling things by their names. And if you want to volunteer, call up. And with my heart in my throat, I called up. And I went down there and I cut wire copy and did various things for 6 months. And at the end, I had a little 7-minute little tape of me reading news. And I kind of walked out of KPFA and walked into New York.
Yes.
Then, of course, at WBAI, even though it was 68 and BAI was the big other Pacifica, very, very radical station,
the news director, the program director, actually played footsie under the table and said women didn't do news, their voices were too high.
We transcended that.
Really amazing. But finally they hired me for nothing, and I kept my day job, and I did a nighttime newscast, and they finally hired me 3 months later after they had a marathon, like right now.
Right.
And they basically said, for $85 a week, you can be our 11 p.m. newscaster. And that's how I started out in radio.
That's so wonderful. That is our great Margo Adler, who is now speaking to us from the great beyond, because she died on, she died on July 28th. So we had a great cahoot. She did start at KPFA. So let's remember again, 1968 to now, that there is a great legacy here. You know, and we're pledging also, you know, for beloved Margo. So as you know, we just played the great interview with Elizabeth Gilbert. You can have the book Signature of All Things. Very powerful woman protagonist. And we're going to begin more with of my conversation with Margo in February, and her great book, Vampires Are Us. We were in the winter fund drive then, which is why she could give that great pitch. It's so poignant. Ha, my goodness. So you can have Vampires Are Us by Margo Adler for a pledge of $90. And just think of praising Margo. Many of you might not have known her, but many, many, many did. You know, all of the publishing people have been in touch go, yes, it's so sad, we can hardly believe it. Ha. So we're going to do some conversing with Margo now, and I will interweave the pitching. But again, you can have Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert for $85, Vampires Are Us for pledge of $90, both for $160, by calling 1-800-439-5732 or 510-848-5732 or pledging online kpfa.org. And now we will interweave smidges of Margo and my conversing from February. To find this book, and we will tell our humans how they can have it. But, you know, you do tease it into the environment, or it wants to be there. You know, us humans, as the rudest species the planet's ever known, I think, is fair to say, you know, are sucking the Earth's blood, you know, oil and water. Do you want to take us into that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, you know, this all started because I was meditating on mortality. My husband was dying. There was all kinds of stuff. And while he was dying, I was obsessing, and I read a ridiculous number of vampire novels. As a matter of fact, 270.
I know.
Yes, it's totally insane. And as I was doing this, at some point, even though I knew I kind of was starting out looking at issues of death and life and immortality, but at some level, I suddenly went, okay, but this doesn't explain why Hollywood spent $7 billion in the last 2 years on vampire movies and television shows. So something else is going on. So the question was, why do vampires have such traction in our culture right now? And you know, everybody said, oh, it's just sex and teens and sex and teens. And I said, no, there's something else going on. And the first thing that happened was I went and talked to this woman who was a Quaker and also taught literature of war, but also taught vampire stuff. And she was at the University of the Pacific. And she suddenly said, every good vampire novel and movie basically asks the same question. Now that we're at the top of the food chain, do we respect humans as humans, or are they just cattle to be preyed upon? And it's no different. It's no different than the question we have to ask ourselves every day. If we have more status, more power, more money, how do we treat them? Does might make right? And so then I said, okay, so there's power, and I started looking at Buffy and power issues. And then at some level, I came across Nina Auerbach's incredible book called Vampires Ourselves. And she had a line in there which was, every age embraces the vampire it needs. And I went, okay, well, what does that mean? And then I started thinking, and I started talking to academics, and I started wandering around, and suddenly I realized that, you know, 1897, Bram Stoker writes Dracula. England has the largest ports in the world, fear of disease, fear of immigration. He creates this incredible monster that brings dirt from afar foreign land, a totally beautiful metaphoric way to deal with the fears and concerns. So you can do that with a lot of periods, but then I said, but that doesn't explain now. What's happening now? And so I took all the most sort of popular vampires that were around over the last 15 years. So there was like Angel and Spike and Buffy. There was, you know, the Cullens in Twilight. There was Bill and Eric in True Blood. There was Stefan and Damon in The Vampire Diaries. On and on. You could just do this. And I put them in a row, and I said, what do they have in common, and in what way are they different from the vampires that went before? And suddenly I had this light bulb moment in which I went, oh, heavens, they're all conflicted. They're all desperately struggling to be moral, despite being predators, often failing, but they're all desperately struggling to be moral, as are we failing too. It's just that our blood is oil, and we are sucking the lifeblood out of the planet. And I remember calling up Whitley Strieber, who had written The Hunger and who's an old friend, and I said, well, you know, does this make sense? And he said, yes, our prey is the planet.
Well, our prey is the planet. That is our beloved Margot Adler, who died on July 28th just now. And this is part of our conversational cavorting from February 6th when we were in Winter Fun Drive. So to honor Margot, there were many, many great people who loved that show and sent in really great comments, too, that I passed on to Margot, and she loved them. Some wonderful listeners said, vampires can't see themselves in the mirror because they are the mirror. And Margot wrote back, brilliant. We go, yes, wonderful, wonderful. So, you know, as a tribute to Margot, really, what a great life, what a great colleague. We will aspire to be interweaving more clips. You'll hear how we first met, and certainly I do not presume to be one of her closest confidants, but she is a treasured, treasured ally, and we go way, way back, as so many of us do with Margot. And again, credible, mystic, credible, pagan, both. Unabashed, really great. And again, as we remember, you know, she started in 1968 in KPFA. So this is a long legacy. We want to kind of honor this station, this show. We want to honor Margot. We are offering Elizabeth Gilbert's book. You just heard the interview at the first part of this hour with her, The Signature of All Things. Really, really powerful and important, really powerful, sweeping. If you love to be swept away in a long, pertinent, powerful, dazzling language, epic. That is a good one for you for a pledge of $85. And then Margot's book, Vampires Are Us, many, many, many great things. And it is the last thing she wrote. We are in this realm of poignancy because we'd said, oh, let's do more shows and let's do many more things. You never know. So Vampires Are Us is the last work by Margot Adler for a pledge of $90. And you can have both for a pledge of $160 by calling 1-800-439-5732 or 510-848-5732 or pledging online kpfa.org. And please do call. I want to play more of Margot because it is so close to her departure, and it is so poignant and powerful. But I'm counting on you, dynamic listening audience, fabulous listening audience, to be calling to pledge either for the books or just for the fun of it, to keep KPFA flourishing in this supportive realm, that it may be replenished, that it may be a vital part of our listening community of replenishment, especially in these wild times where we're really going showtime. This is a great moment to pledge to KPFA. Again, 1-800-439-5732 or 510-848-5732, and we're going back to a little bit more of Margot and me.
To say that I started at KPFA, you guys. I started in 1968.
Woo-hoo!
It was my first radio place. It's a long story how I got there, but I was a student at Berkeley. And if it wasn't for KPFA, I probably would never, never have gotten into radio.
Yay, okay. So which
call
is... Well, we're doing it again. That's right. She touted KPFA, bless her heart, many times in that particular interview. So, yes, it gives me an opportunity to go, yes, and reciprocally back to Margot. She did think of death as cavorting in the Summerlands. I really hope that's true. Margot, hello, we love you. And so you're pledging not only to KPFA and the Visionary Activist Show, but to the beautiful life of Margot Adler and her book, Vampires Are Us, which is witty, 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 profound, profound, very trippy. And, you know, I'm pretty sure we're going to get to some essential parts of the interview with Margot Adler, in which she says, you know, when culture is, you know, full of dingbattery, the truth or wisdom gets exiled to these kind of genres of, you know, swamp thing, comic books, vampire stuff, all important, all part of our public dream, and all guiding us, in a sense, as KPFA is also a part of our public dreaming, our, you know, the art of directing collective attention on what's really important. So we'll be diving right back in, but do call! You can have Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert for $85, or Margot's book Vampires Are Us by Margot Adler for a pledge of $90, both for $160, 1-800-439-5732, or 510-848-5732, and here's Margot and me cavorting.
So there's this quote by this woman named Victoria Nelson. She's a professor at Goddard, and she kind of channeled the spirit of the science fiction writer Philip K. Dick.
Yay.
And this quote is just really amazing. It's kind of, I just want to talk a little bit about it. It says, when the divine is exiled from art and culture, from what elites consider, and this is important, what elites consider art and culture, sometimes you have to search for it in the trash.
Yes.
And I think what I want to talk about that is genre fiction is dissed in our culture. You know, it's not something that gets a lot of reviews in the New York Times Book Review, and it's very much looked down on in our culture. And so people, of course, came to me and said, how could you spend 3.5 years of your life, you're an intellectual, you're this, that, and the other, how could you spend 3.5 years reading vampire novels, you know, right? And so I had to, like, think about genre a bit, and I went to Ursula K. Le Guin, who's one of my favorite authors.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
Ursula K. Le Guin wrote two novels that are just like should be in everybody's literary canon, The Dispossessed and The Left Hand of Darkness. And she wrote a whole bunch of other stuff. But anyway, those two novels are my favorite. But anyway, she wrote an essay called Why Are People Afraid of Dragons? And she says about herself that everybody calls her work speculative fiction, but if left to her own design, she would say, I write novels. And so this essay, Why Are People Afraid of Dragons, or something like that title, basically ends up saying people are afraid of dragons because they're afraid of freedom. And so very often I think people are afraid of genre fiction, particularly science fiction, speculative fiction, and other kinds of things, because in some way the most interesting ideas that really breach the edge of our culture and go outward are in that kind of literature. And people are afraid. People are really afraid to even tackle that. Some people are, at least.
Well,
and so, don't you think?
Well, yeah, and a spirit ally just texted in too, going, has Margot read Alan Moore's Swamp Thing versus Underwater Vampires, crucial to what she just presented? Do you know? Because now we're in comic books, right? Another dissed important realm.
Exactly.
Do you know Swamp Thing?
I don't.
Oh,
comic books are one of the things that I sort of never got totally into.
We'll guide you. We'll guide you. Because this field goes on forever. But yes, and as you delineate, it is my reading and watch list in this book, Vampires Are Us Forever, going, oh, I will never be without a narrative again. Yes, I love diving into all the things you dive into, detectives,
yeah,
and then detectives.
It turns out that vampire literature is everywhere. It's romance, it's science fiction, it's alternate history, it's geeky teen turn, you know, wonderful books about, you know, 15-year-old is turned and he has acne for the rest of his life, right, you know. I mean, it's, you know, all kinds of comic novels, like Pratchett has lots of vampires in his novels. There's all kinds of humor. I mean, literally there are probably 20 different types of genres that vampire literature comprises. And one of the interesting things that happened as I was looking through this and as I was thinking about this is I wrote a letter to Anne Rice, and I said, you know, I didn't know where I was at the beginning. I said, dear Anne Rice, I'm looking for why vampires have traction in our culture. You know, could you please answer me? And she answered me, and she said, I don't really know. The vampire's an outsider, blah, 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 blah. And then she said this sentence, which has completely blown my mind. And this is the sentence. The sentence is, but for teens, they are attracted to vampires because they so desperately seek a noble path through the hideous passage that Western culture has set up for them. And I started thinking about that sentence. I started thinking about high school, I started thinking about all these kids who've been reading Twilight and how in Twilight, the Cullens have to go to high school over and over and over. Think about having to go to your senior prom 5 times. Now, that's a horror story. And so when you think about what kids really have to go through, what teens have to go through, corporate culture, jock culture, pressures of parents, pressures of school. I mean, we could go on and on and on and list all the hideous things that people, that teens have to experience in the high school years. And you suddenly understand that vampires and other things like them are very much a way of sort of creating one's independence from that. And one of the most fascinating books that I read during this journey was not a novel at all. It was a book called Liquid Dreams of Vampires. And there was a guy named Ricardo who basically had analyzed the fantasies of hundreds and hundreds of men and women about vampires. And what was the most striking thing about them was that these people didn't want to meet vampires, have sex with vampires. They wanted to be them. And almost everyone I've come across, including myself, suddenly realizes that our relationship is we want some of those things. We want to be some of those strengths, some of those abilities, but also, you know, there's something in that image that is very much something that we want.
Well, and I just, you know, identification with the dark, okay, the outsider identification with the dark, I mean, reading your fabulous book, Vampires Are Us, you know, stirred up so much. As a little girl, the youngest of five and also kind of like an only kid because everybody's like 14 years older, but we'd go to the museum and they go, wouldn't you like this nice little Renoir print of the woman, the little girl holding the watering can? I go, no, I want the dogs from hell. I want the Doberman pinchers howling in the under. I want the dangerous dark thing. And they're like, no, that's not a good movie. That's not a good thing for a little girl. You know, could we take you to a nice movie? No, I want Solomon and Sheba. Anyway, they go, that's not a movie for a little girl. I'm gonna take me there. But I mean, I think, you know, so, you know, from where we started, I think we met at Witch Camp a million years ago. In which
I forget where we met.
Well, but there was like I remember
some festival.
I remember our first conversation. It was Witch Camp, and the everybody could set up little kind of events for people to go to. But the crones set up. Yes, okay. The crones set up this cave where you entered, and you were cradled on their laps, and then you looked into
Jerry
a mirror.
Had on an incredible, from her own history, a complete leather outfit, remember, from a pioneer, and she sat on this huge rocking chair, and you went into this cave, and you sat on her lap,
right.
And you were rocked by the grandmother you never had.
Right, and then you looked into a mirror, and they said, someday you will be lucky enough to be an old woman. And I walked out, and I ran into you immediately as I was sort of like, wow, and I go, wow, the crones, that was a class act. And you said, that was such a class act. And I think that was our first conversation. But it brings us to important things that we both, everyone loves and that you've been dedicated to. This issue of initiation. You know, which is, you know, we might say, you know, many ways to dive into what is wrong with our species. And we go, well, the issue of the uninitiated Mars, you know, we have a hyper-yang death frenzy that's, you know, sucking the blood of the planet. And today Congress, for the second time, denies unemployment benefits. And it's like, oh, so many people who are broke. Pledge anyway, we'll come back to that. And so few people who are mega wealthy, and they can be kind, some of them, of course, you know, but, you know, we go, that's so vampire-ish. Anyway, but yeah, so I think that was our first, like, wow, the crones are a class act. That was a real initiation because it was a powerful, well, it was really real. It was like, I mean, people walked out going, oh my God, that was kind of completely real. It's disguised, like, detective novels, like vampire novels, like whatever, disguised as a kind of corny thing, it was real. And we go, yeah, and again, you know, New Orleans, dear to both of us, and I want to come back to Anne Rice and all that complexity, but I just remember taking my late great friend Jim Lewis. He was guiding me around New Orleans the first time we went. We went into the tourist thing, the Voodoo Museum, and there was a little sign that said, you know, pay $5 to go into the back room, working altar. And I said, come on, Jim, I'll spot you. And he's like, no, it's a tourist thing. I was like, come on. So we did. We paid our $5, and we walked in, and immediately it was like, whoa, it's real. You know, so the cover of Kitsch, the cover of the fantasy novel, the detective novel, the sci-fi thing, Doris Lessing got so dissed for her most profound work. You know, you talk about Olaf Stapleton, and, you know, and Philip K. Dick, again, who in his life, right, he dies right as the movie contract's coming in, going, oh, I'm about to be not broke. Ah, hell, God, I'm dead. But anyway, so all of our, you know, interesting shadow and identification with the dark, and the New Orleans thing after Katrina had all these great New Orleans beings on, and people asked them what they asked you, which elicited this great quote in your book, why are you spending all this time with Schlock? And people in New Orleans, you know, came to New Orleans and said, why are you spending all your money on costumes and voodoo parades? And they said, because it is our soul, because it keeps everything alive, because that is the first thing that allows other things to come in. And so, yeah, so anyway, so I think I read a bunch of Anne Rice novels, but I think and there is sex in there. We'll come back to the erotic thing.
But it's very different. It's not genital sex.
Well, isn't there spirit sex that ravishes her on an airplane, and then there's a spirit thing, and then there's a rough sex with a fireman guy? And
in Anne Rice?
Yeah.
I mean, not in the vampires. The vampires don't have genital sex. They have blood exchange and all kinds of stuff, but they don't. And Yarbrough doesn't. Now, on the other hand, I read...
Wait, who be Yarbrough? Who?
All the Count de Saint Germain novels. He doesn't have genital sex. On the other hand, the very modern romance novels are total soft porn, and some of them are so formulaic that, you know, you'll read these books that'll have like 8 different sex scenes in the book, and they'll all be kind of like, oh, he fills me, you know, you want to just throw up, you know. They're really bad. And then there are some beautiful ones as well, but that whole notion that it's sort of this genital sex is I think more modern.
But yes, that you know, but necks, of course, you know, who doesn't like having just that spot in their neck kissed?
Oh, ah, yeah.
I mean, it is a, it is a, but I would get to the end of, you know, Anne Rice's 800,000 page novel and throw it across the room going, I waited through all of that for that. And as you address in your book, you know, although she sold 76 million copies, some people wouldn't read them. Book reviewer friend of mine said it's too weird because her daughter died of leukemia, and this is all kind of her neurotic dealing with the thing. And we go, that's too simple. It's too simple.
Much too simple.
But it definitely caught a wave, 76 million copies, my God. And it's not like it's great literature, and it's not even like it's a great, you know, storytelling, really. I mean, I was really annoyed at the end of all the ones I read, although I did, you know, obviously read more than one, for God's sake, going, hoping, because it is something deep in our souls, but it was so mean. Ugh. I'm running into so mean. So there's the, you know, there's the Anne Rice phenomenon that says, whoa, this is tapping into this deep thing. And then, I love the detective genre because these are all myths, and I want to toss this back to you on this one. You know, it's like fairy tales are kind of more local versions of big myths, and then they wend their way into sci-fi, fantasy, vampire stuff, and so on, kind of even more intimately. And we go, oh, but the detective genre, I because I love it so, was like, well, when did this start? 221 BC in China is crime writing, in which they have famous detectives. This is a very old impulse, and it was always to the detective or the judge magistrate was to explore evil and then guide human affairs to be once again in accord with the mandate of heaven. And then they had great, you know, 6th century famous detective. But I was amazed, like going 221 BC, it's still existing on paper made of bamboo, which apparently lasts forever. But anyway, so these are very old, the myths, even the detective novels, the crime, the exploration of evil, the different genres, and then, of course, you're doing the vampire thing, which is everywhere
pertinent.
The number of vampire detectives that there are in literature are amazing. I mean, I have a whole section in the book all about sort of detective vampire novels. And there's even a section, you'll love this, there's a section on presidential vampire thrillers.
Yes, I do love that.
There's actually a book called In Pursuit of Darkness. Pursuit of Darkness.
Oh, I got it. Yes.
And the vampire is actually a Karl Rove figure.
Of course. Well, no stretch of the imagination there.
That was me, Caroline Gacy, talking a little bit too much with beloved Margot Adler, who died July 28th at 10:30 a.m., 29 Virgo Rising, which is an emergency call. One's attention goes to matters at hand. Let's take her dedication to magic and journalism and nature on out into the world. Identification with the dark, the whole realm of initiation. Very often people come up to me and say, KPFA has been my initiation. You know, I've been listening to you for 18 years. You raised me. Many forms of initiation. So let me just, as we're going out, exhort. Pledge for beloved Margot Adler. And again, you can find that radio interview in KPFA.org's archives, February 6th, Visionary Activist Show, or Coyote Network News in the radio archives. Because the whole thing is great. And I, again, apologize for me talking too much at the end on that thing, because she has lots more to say. So do pledge 1-800-439-5732 or 510-848-5732 for Margot's book, Margot Adler's book, Vampires Are Us, for a pledge of $90, or The Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert for a pledge of $85, or both for $160. Thanks very much, of course, to our wonderful ally, Alex Drewinskis in Washington, D.C., and Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. I'm Caroline Casey. Keep pledging, kpfa.org. And all love to you, beloved Margot Adler. May you journey well. One more. And we will reconvene next week. Thank you, team.